From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with journalist and former U.S. Ambassador William Atwood. His new book, The Twilight Struggle, is about his 40 years covering the Cold War for the American press. Also today, I talk with writer and director Luis Valdez about how he went from migrant farm work to Broadway and Hollywood. Valdez wrote the play Zoot Suit and the new movie La Bamba. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Ideal Copy, the new album from the British group Wire. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews RoboCop, the first American film from Dutch director Paul Verhoeven. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is journalist and former U.S. Ambassador William Atwood. His new book, The Twilight Struggle, is a history of the Cold War from his perspective as a journalist and diplomat. To Atwood, the Cold War has been a struggle that ultimately defied definition but was continually refueled by ignorance, greed, and fear. Atwood covered the Cold War for 40 years for several newspapers, as well as Life, Look, and Collier's magazines. His work took him to Eastern Europe, Cuba, Africa, China, the Soviet Union. In 1960, Atwood was appointed ambassador to Guinea, which he described as a tropical, tragicomic circus rife with Cold War intrigue. He was later appointed ambassador to Kenya, where he continued to find elements of Cold War friction. William Atwood recently retired from his position as publisher for the New York newspaper Newsday. He returned yesterday from Cuba, where he was part of a visiting delegation organized by the Council on U.S.-Cuban Relations. His new book is titled The Twilight Struggle, Tales of the Cold War. William Atwood, welcome to Fresh Air.
Glad to be here. You got it all right.
Oh, good. That's nice.
I'm glad you stressed the second part of the title, Tales of the Cold War, because that was my title. The publishers wanted the heavier one, but this, what the book really is a series of stories, anecdotes, things that I saw, did, experienced. And I think history told that way is not only more entertaining, but sometimes more accurate because you're not drawing on other sources. These are things you actually saw with your own eyes or
yeah.
smelt and felt. And luckily, I saved up a lot of old notebooks, diaries, letters, things like that.
It's funny how your beat developed into the Cold War. You know, no matter what story you were covering, it ended up being a Cold War story.
Well, there was a time in the late 40s and early 50s when that's about all, if you were stationed abroad, as I was, that's all people wanted to hear about. It was like covering some kind of Olympic Games that were never ending. And it was, we were all, in a sense, war correspondents. And I know we had a cliche lead to any story from any capital in Eastern Europe, but it was one of the games we used to play, and it went, Red Terror gripped the city tonight as grim-faced Tommy gunners patrolled the rubble-strewn streets. Well, you know, it was that silly. There were all kinds of Cold War cliches, which a lot of them persisted to this day, and a lot of it was true at the time of Stalin. But the Cold War changed when he died, and much of our thinking has not. I mean, I think there are people in Washington still who make policy as if he were alive and well in the Kremlin.
I'd like to know what the source of those cliches was. Was it the editors back home who wanted the Cold War terror grip the streets type leads?
Sure. That's what sold tickets, really. If you could get Stalin or Red Terror or something in the headline, why it had a much better chance of getting space than it didn't. And we ourselves, you know, were carried away by this. I mean, we'd penetrate, which was something that really was an iron curtain. It was hard to get through. And when we did, we felt like we felt that we were in a war. We'd gotten behind enemy lines. It was an entirely different feeling than you know, exists today, thank goodness.
When you were writing your Cold War terror type leads, were you aware of what was happening back on the home front with McCarthy and the UAC hearings?
Oh, very much. I never approved of McCarthy because, I mean, he was just playing this for his own purposes, and he was harming a lot of people I knew in Europe, you know, very dedicated public servants who were who knew a lot more about how to wage the Cold War than he did. So he was in a great embarrassment to us as Americans, because even our friends were, you know, thought that America was either going crazy or going fascist. Then he sent Roy Cohn, who died recently, and then about 26, and this other little aide of his, Shine, his name was, wandering around Europe, just destroying the careers of perfectly decent people, purging our USIA libraries, and they were literally burning books outside. And the Germans had never seen books burned since Hitler, and they were doing it. So it was embarrassing to see this happening, and a lot of my friends were had their careers damaged by this man.
You were talking about the language that writers had to use covering the Cold War in American magazines. Now, thinking that political leaders as well have used very colorful and dramatic language. And you talk about John F. Kennedy, who started using the term adversary instead of enemy to describe the Soviet Union. What do you think were his reasons for that shift in language?
I think it was very important. It was sort of subtle, but you know, you can have an adversary on the on a football field or the baseball diamond, and he's not your enemy. The game's over. You know, you're still friends. You struggled, and he had this feeling, I think, after talking and getting to know the Russians better. You know, when he and Khrushchev had an exchange of about 49 private letters, which had never been published, but will be next year. And I think they began to understand each other as people, and he didn't consider him an enemy, but as an opponent. And I think this was very, very important. And Nixon did something like this, too. At one point, when we were trying to establish contact with the Chinese, after being tied in with Chiang Kai-shek for all these years, Nixon in one speech used the phrase the People's Republic of China. And always we had used the phrase communist occupied China. Well, just that subtle change was picked up by the Chinese and made a difference.
So you think when American leaders have toned down their language that communist leaders have responded in kind.
Usually, and you know, it doesn't befit us. We're such a the big power, and you go back to Theodore Roosevelt's slogan about speaking softly and carrying a big stick. Well, everybody knows we have a big stick. Not that we can use it because now it's nuclear, but now we have a reputation for being a superpower, even though we're spending more than we're making. But we are, and for us to talk, street language and insult other countries and denounce them as whether they're evil, crooks and bums and thugs. I don't think it's befitting at all. I think we should watch our language and expect the same from them.
So you think language is usually a good barometer of where we are in the Cold War?
It is. I think right now. I think we were. The Cold War, I have a feeling, is just about over, although we don't realize it. But it reached a kind of a crescendo, not a serious one. I think since the missile confrontation in Cuba in 1962, when we looked at the chasm of the danger of nuclear war, and we backed off, I think at that point both sides said, we're never going to get this close to conflict again, and we never have. But there have been times when the flames were stoked. I mean, when Reagan started referring to the Soviet Union as an evil empire, well, this accomplished nothing, you know. And the words and the rhetoric got very cute. They even started talking about Reagan in terms of Darth Vader at one point. Well, this did no good. But in 1983, it kind of stopped and calmed down. And then I was in Geneva when Gorbachev and Reagan met. And right away, you could see they were talking with each other as human beings, not as though they had horns on or Darth Vader masks. And right away, you just felt. And I can't say it's more than a feeling, but it's a feeling that the Cold War was ending.
Well, you're talking about the Cold War as ending, but I wonder if you think that the Iran-Contra investigations are part of a new chapter in the Cold War.
That's a domestic problem. It's just a lot of loose cannons, unguided missiles, and gung-ho types, you know, like Ali North and others who just love the action for action's sake, and sort of running amok. But that's an American problem. The Soviets were not involved in this, and the same thing with Iran. Every time there seems to be trouble in the world, any barroom brawl, we have to sort of stick our nose into it for some reason. I don't know why we want to barge into the Soviet Gulf. I don't know why we sent Marines to Lebanon, 240 of whom got killed. They didn't know why they were there. We didn't know why they were there. But that sort of thing should stop. But that's not really part of the cold of what we call the rivalry between us and them. I think what's happening really is that it's beginning to dawn on a lot of Americans, and it certainly has on the Russians, that we really don't want anything from each other. Wars have always started with people wanted territory, or they wanted raw materials, they wanted markets, Lebensraum like Hitler. Well, we don't want that. We don't want to occupy Russia. They don't want to occupy us. They have a hard enough time in Eastern Europe and Afghanistan. So suddenly, what are the reasons for this hostility? What's it all about? I mean, who profits from it? Well, people who build armaments do, but no one else.
My guest is William Atwood, who's written a chronicle of his 40 years covering Cold War stories, and the book is called The Twilight Struggle, Tales of the Cold War. In the 1950s, there were a lot of CIA operatives who were undercover as journalists, and I'd like to know if you were aware of that at the time.
Oh, we were all aware, but I don't say there were a lot of them. There were some, usually freelance writers. Occasionally they would come to me when I was an editor at Look and say, we want somebody in India. He'll write for you, but we'll pay for him. And
the CIA would come to you.
Yeah, and we'd say no. I'd tell our people, wherever I was at Newsday too, I said, if you go on a trip to China, Russia, whatever, one of these so-called communist countries, and you come back and you want to talk to the CIA, that's fine. I don't mind. I do it myself because I think the CIA needs accurate information. I think they're getting a lot of inaccurate stuff from the people they pay. And I don't, you know, as a patriotic American, I think we should feed them that sort of information, but never see them before you go on a trip because that makes you a spy. They'll say, watch out for this and look for that, and that's out. And they tried this in the New York Times once, and Turner Catledge, the managing editor, was so mad they were going to approach somebody, some writer, and he called them and said, if anybody approaches you, it's a phony, so just don't do it. But no, it's very counterproductive because then the press won't have anything to do with someone who does something like that. I mean, you're a pariah in your own profession.
I'm surprised to hear you say that you supported the policy at some magazines of talking to the CIA on the return from a
coming
trip
back
abroad.
Well, you would talk to your neighbors and to your friends and to your family. You know, what did you see? How was it?
But they're the CIA, not your
neighbors. Well, if you're going to tell it to your friends, and all the more reason, it seems to me, if you know the information is accurate, to get a little input there that is accurate. Because so much of what I've seen, unevaluated information that drifts into the CIA is sent in by agents who were trying to make an extra buck by juicing up their information.
But do you think that would undermine a journalist's credibility, especially to their sources abroad, if their sources knew that after they report to their editor, then they turn around and report to the CIA?
Not at all. I think they expect that we do. And I think that...
But isn't that a problem for journalists abroad, that expectation that somehow they're channeled into the CIA?
No, it's not a problem. I mean, and it was British for years. I mean, it was well known that the London Times correspondent, wherever he was always doing double duty, which is not the case in here. This is just a case of talking to your government when you come home, or not, as you wish,
So it was up to the individual journalist to decide. Let's talk a little bit about different places that you've been covering stories for magazines and newspapers in America. You were in East Berlin before the wall separating East and West Berlin was built. What was the difference between the two cities in feeling at the time? Both cities were
well. It's not so much feeling as appearance. I mean, you were in West Berlin. You were in a bustling, thriving, neon lit part that was full of consumer goods, and of course, it was free access back and forth. And you went into East Berlin, and it was so you were transported back in time to 1947. You know. Poverty and there were still ruined buildings, and it wasn't until about 1952 or 3 that they really started equalizing the started rebuilding in the East and housing and East Germany is really quite a success story, because in spite of communism, in spite of which is a failed economic system, in spite of the Russian occupation and the fact that the Soviets looted their part of Germany. In spite of all that, they've come back strong, and they are now one of the leading industrial members of the East Bloc, and that's just that German will to work that did it. And so I think that's quite admirable what they've done there. I've had some fairly scary times there, because we didn't have relations with the Germans, so East Germans. So if they arrested you...
Almost got arrested, right?
I got arrested several times, and... But usually for taking pictures and being at meetings where I wasn't supposed to be. And once I had some East German money that I wasn't supposed to have. I didn't know I wasn't supposed to have it. And they held me for 2 hours and grilled me. And then they let me off with only a $50 fine. But if they'd wanted to, there was nothing they couldn't do to me. And I had that strange feeling, because there was no one I could call. We had no embassy or anything there. And I had the same experience in Poland, and it was very revealing in those days in the 50s when these were really tough police states. Some of them still are, like Romania, but some of them are really much far looser now, where we got arrested just for taking pictures, and they wouldn't let us call the embassy, they wouldn't let us call anybody, even our Polish friends in the newspapers. And finally they found they couldn't develop Polaroid films, so they said, you can go now. But we had two Polish hitchhikers with us, and I said, what about them? Oh, they stay. I said, no, if they stay, we stay. You can then get as tough as you want. You start scaring them and saying, I'm going to report you back when I get back to Warsaw for interfering with our movements as legitimate guests of the government. And you make them sweat a little. But if you were a Pole, you realize you're totally at their mercy. And that was what was scary, chilling about being in those countries at that time. And it's improved a lot since then in some countries. Hungary, it's improved a lot. Poland, I think Romania and Czechoslovakia is still a place where dogs don't bark, as they say.
My guest is William Atwood, and he covered Cold War stories for 40 years for the American press, and he's written a new book that's a memoir. It's titled The Twilight Struggle, Tales of the Cold War. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist William Atwood is my guest. He recently retired from the position of publisher of Newsday, a New York newspaper, and he's written a memoir titled The Twilight Struggle, Tales of the Cold War. You just returned from Cuba. Now, you were first in Cuba in, I guess it was the late 1950s, just as Castro was coming to power.
Right after the revolution, yeah. Then I've been back off and on in the 60s and 70s, and this is my first trip in about 8 years, and but it was about 100 degrees, so I managed to have caught cold down there, because it was a combination of 100 degrees outside and air conditioning inside was more than I could stand.
An exaggeration of the typical American summer and constant change in temperatures. I guess it was in 1959 when you were in Cuba, you were interviewing Castro, and he ended up interviewing you about your knowledge of communist countries. And from the way you described it, it sounded like he had just very little firsthand information of it, and really didn't know what life was like in communist
countries.
He had a
lot to learn. He did. Well, he was sort of a white up. He had lived only in Cuba and Mexico and all, was as a revolutionary. He really didn't know much about the outside world. And the Communist Party of Cuba, which really wasn't part of his revolution at the beginning, then realized this and moved in, and he was very impressionable, and they convinced him that their system was the only one. Of course, we ourselves didn't do very much. We took a hands-off attitude, so he really didn't have much choice of who to turn to. But I don't think there's much we could have done, because he was such a revolutionary. He was too radical for our tastes. I mean, he would, you know, nationalizing companies and taking this really crazy economic, appeared to be crazy economic road, we just couldn't accept. But there was really no reason for this permanent state of hostility we've been in, because of all the communist countries, Cuba is probably the one I would least object having to live in. People are cheerful, you know, there's some gaiety around, and he himself is a fascinating guy. I mean, you know, I disagree with him half the time, but half the time you say so. He doesn't mind. He argues back. I mean, he's got a sense of humor, and you don't feel you're talking to some duck-speaking thug as you do in Bulgaria and places like that. But for some reason, we grafted horns on him years ago and decided that he was the incarnation of all evil and behind all of the problems everywhere. And it's too bad. I don't say that we need Cuba or that they need us all that much, but it's sort of unnatural. It casts us in the role of a bully in the world, you know. And
were you aware when you were a journalist of the American government's efforts to topple Castro and even to kill him?
I wasn't. No, I wasn't aware. None of us were. It was very secret, and it came out in the Senate Intelligence hearings, which I testified. Then I found out when I read the reports of the hearings, all of the various weird tricks we were trying to CIA, and not with the knowledge of the president. So, you know, what's been going on recently is just not for the first time. Neither Kennedy nor Johnson nor Eisenhower, nor Nixon, rather, I should say, were really aware of some of these incredible things we were trying to pull off in Cuba, like sprinkling his shoes with some kind of powder that would make his beard fall off if he rubbed his beard, and exploding seashells when he went skin diving. I mean, it was just out of a bad movie. And, of course, it's hard for him to forget these things. And so when somebody said to him, you know, a great problem to us that you're only 90 miles from our shores, he said, well, look at it my way. I think it's a great problem that you're 90 miles from mine, and with a lot more justification, I think. And no, I think he's in hock to the Russians because they're supporting his economy, and it was totally based on sugar. Have been able to diversify, so there's not much he can do but be dependent.
Journalist William Atwood is my guest. In the toward the conclusion of your memoir of covering the Cold War for the American press, you write some of the things that you learned during your years as a journalist. What you learned about the Cold War, and you write that you learned our enemy isn't communism, but stupidity. And I'd like to ask you what you meant by that.
Well, it's our own, I think our own lack of understanding of what the world's all about. See, communism is a word that really has very little meaning anymore. In fact, in the Soviet Lithuania, somebody said it really doesn't exist. It's like some light from some fading star. It's a billion years old. We think the star is there, but it isn't. And ideology does not motivate people the way we think it does. Nationalism does. And it's Russian nationalism which keeps that country together. And so I decided, you know, that communism was not something you could identify. What is it, Yugoslav communism, Chinese communism, Czech communism? I mean, they're all different varieties. And besides which, If people want to take that road, let them find out that it doesn't work. It's not a concern of ours. Our only concern was at one time that it was that not communism, but the Soviet state was aggressive and bent on doing us harm. Now, that was true under Stalin. I don't think it's been true since. I think they're more reasonable than that. And so, but as a result, we've piled up mountains of weapons that are not really weapons because we can't use them. I mean, nobody can use nuclear weapons. They're suicide machines. And gradually we realize that. So when that finally dawns on people, I think this Cold War will be over. I think it is over. We don't yet realize it. And when it is over, we're going to enjoy a kind of a prosperity we've never known before. So I actually met Gorbachev in February very briefly, and I said, I got a line I'd like to suggest for you to make in a speech if you come to the States. I said, try this one. You know, we talk and talk about peace through strength, and why not start talking about strength through peace? Because if we could only unload this frightful arms burden, why, we'd have, our budget would be balanced, you know? We'd be a stronger country, and theirs would, too.
You write that in all the years you were writing serious analytical pieces for the press, that the stories that you got the biggest response from were your lighthearted entertainment stories that you would mm-hmm. occasionally do. Is that discouraging?
No, I like to be entertained, too. I like lighthearted things. I mean, only a minority of the people are really concerned about important issues. I think Reagan's a great strength, and the reason he was elected twice is because basically he's an entertainer and a very good one. And the American people would always rather be entertained than to be governed. And that's the secret of his success. I hope it doesn't become a habit with our politicians, because I think we also need to be governed. We have some hard problems to solve, and I don't think a few wisecracks and happy grins are going to do it. But I think we've had this experience with Mr. Reagan, and probably hasn't done us all that much harm. We're going to have to get out of a hock somehow, but I think we'll manage.
When you were a journalist traveling around the world a lot, you used to have lost baggage nightmares all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And bad dreams about missing planes and ruining interviews.
Yeah, sure.
Still have them?
Less, but since I've been doing it less. If you'll notice in your own dreams, it's sort of interesting because I talked to one of these dream specialist physicians once. You usually dream, I mean, your recurring dreams are about things that happened 25 years ago. I used to have war dreams 25 years after the war. You know, I was 4 years in the Army in various theaters. And then before that, I would have college dreams, you know, the ones where you haven't been to class all year and the exam's coming up and you can't find the exam room and, you know, that sort of panic. And then when I was a foreign correspondent running around, missing my planes and losing my typewriter, I had those kind of dreams 25 years later. So now I'm trying to think what I was doing 25 years ago. Oh, yeah, so I was an executive, you know, in the communications business. So I guess I should probably be having dreams about balancing budgets, but I haven't had any of those yet. I sleep better.
You were a publisher for a few years at New York Newsday. Did that fulfill a dream for you? Did you always want to be a publisher?
I was always curious about what they did. And I found out. Everything is fun. Every new experience is fun. And after a while, you say, well, I've learned all I have to I can learn about this, and I've done what they asked me to do, and why continue? And that's really what happened. And I've never held a job, any one job, more than 8 years, 9 years, I guess. Everything goes stale after 9 years, I found.
I know what you're doing is writing books.
Pardon me?
Yeah,
I wouldn't have written these several books otherwise, right?
Well, I want to thank you for talking with
us.
Well,
I had a lot of fun this afternoon. Well, worth it. Hope to see you again.
Thanks for coming. Thanks. My guest has been journalist William Atwood, and he's written a chronicle of his 40 years covering the Cold War for the American press. His book is called The Twilight Struggle, Tales of the Cold War. It's published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, we'll feature a live concert of American popular songs with singer Susanna McCorkle, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Luis Valdez, writer and director of the new film La Bamba, talks about his own childhood as a migrant farm worker. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Wire, a group that was originally part of the British punk scene, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the thriller RoboCop. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the first new album in 7 years from the British group Wire. Ken says the band and their music have mellowed.
In 1977, an English band called Wire released an album called Pink Flag. Arriving in the midst of the English punk rock era, Pink Flag was a shock. There were 21 songs, most of them less than a minute long. The music was harsh, with simple, slashing guitar chords and muffled vocals. And the effect was puzzling and unsettling. While most punk rock at the time was railing against something, from complacent government to complacent music business, Wire's purposes were harder to place. Looking at the lyric sheet, the words were little more than surrealistic images strung together. But when combined with the music, they gave off a sense of emotional urgency. Wire has a new album out, but first, I want to play a cut from that 1977 album, Pink Flag. This tiny composition is called It's So Obvious. Are you still there? That's it. Only 53 seconds. Wasn't bad at all, was it? After Pink Flag, Wire made three more albums and then stopped for 7 years. While the individual members of this quartet made solo albums and played with other bands, they never approached the intensity of their Wire albums. Now Wire has a new record out called The Ideal Copy. I don't think it's as exciting as Pink Flag. Listening to that one 10 years later, I'm still impressed at how well it holds up. The new Wire album places the same emphasis on rhythm and grinding guitar figures, but the melodies are more obvious, as if the fellows felt they had to spell everything out to young listeners who've come along since 1980. They still favor incomprehensible lyrics, but there's a dreary croon to Colin Newman's voice these days that wipes away much of the music's bracing tension. Despite these reservations, I think Wire still makes interesting music that doesn't sound much like any other rock and roll. The band's songs are also longer these days. Here's an excerpt from a new Wire song called The Point of Collapse.
Checking
That was the English band Wire from its first album in 7 years called The Ideal Copy. There's a fine line there, I think, between moody music and mood music, one that Wire crosses regularly, but even when the band flirts with boredom, it's a provocative boredom. Perhaps 7 years from now, they'll make another album that explodes on the music scene the way Pink Flag did. Wire seems to be in this for the long haul.
Our rock critic Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed The Ideal Copy, the new album by Wire. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is playwright and director Luis Valdez. He's written and directed a new film about the life of Chicano rock and roll star Ritchie Valens. It's called La Bamba. Like Ritchie Valens, Valdez grew up in the migrant labor camps in California's San Fernando Valley. Valdez escaped from that life by writing and staging plays. He founded El Teatro Campesino to tour and perform plays in support of the United Farm Workers. Valdez is best known for his 1978 play, Zoot Suit, based on a real incident in 1942 when 22 Chicano gang members were wrongly accused of a murder. All of his work is aimed at dramatizing the Chicano experience within American culture. When I spoke with Luis Valdez, he told me how he fell in love with theater.
I was like 6 years old, and we were in this huge migrant labor camp in the West Valley in California called Corcoran. And we were picking cotton. Cotton season ended, and we couldn't leave the camp because the truck had broken down, my dad's truck had pickup. And this is 1946. We're talking the fall of 1946. Things were still scarce, believe it or not. Brown paper bags were scarce. So one of the things that I did was fold my little bag very carefully, so my lunch, and take it home. One day after school, I go get my bag, and it's missing, and in the cloakroom. And the teacher saw me looking. The bus was waiting. And she says, "You're looking for your bag?" And I said, "Yes." And she says, "I have it. Come with me." And she took me to this little back room, and my bag was all shredded, cut up into little pieces, and floating in this basin of water. And I said, "What did you do? What did you do to my bag?" And she says, "Look." And then right next to it was a clay mold. There was a monkey's face molded in clay. And next to that was another mask, another mold, but with papier-mâché on it. But what the mask was for a play. And so I tried out for a part and got the role. I was going to play a monkey, you know, in a Christmas play about Christmas in the jungle. I enjoyed it. The costume that they measured me for and eventually fitted me for was better than my own clothes. It was incredible. So I, with great joy, I saw the preparations. I mean, maybe it's more elaborate in my mind than it was back then, but it seemed like a Disneyland to me. So I was in the play, looking forward to it, and then the week we were going to do it, my dad got the truck fixed and we moved away.
Oh.
So I was never in the Christmas play. So in order to make up for that gap, that unfillable gap, I started staging plays at that age with my friends. Found an old house, we put up trees, I direct them. By the time I was 7, I started, you know, as soon as I could really write legibly, I started putting together scripts. Theater was my obsession from then on, until this day. You understand? It's been more than 40 years now.
So as a child, you had put on plays for your friends and family to come to?
Oh, yeah. My friends, eventually, in my grandfather's garage, I opened up a little puppet theater, and puppets were much easier to manage than my friends, you know, and I could make them out of papier-mâché and paint them, and stage shows. A cardboard box turned upside down became our stage. We had a little curtain. My older brother got involved, you know, sort of, he was my first producer, in a way. And he collected the nickels at the door.
But how old were you when you said to yourself, when I grow up, I'm not going to be a migrant worker?
Oh, that didn't take too long. You know, I mean, I was still a kid, actually, working in the fields. There were all kinds of possibilities coming out of that, but it was clear to me that the way out was through education or through the use of my imagination.
Had you been exposed to a lot of literature or any theater when you were growing up as a migrant worker?
Yeah, one of the things that I did do is read a lot as a kid. You know, that's really, before the days before television, you know, we barely had radio. I mean, I go back to the days of Straight Arrow and Bobby Benson and the B-Bar-B Writers and The Shadow, you know, all those old radio programs. I followed them avidly. I loved stories and read many of the classics, you know. I mean, you know, Treasure Island, the whole shot, you know, and let my imagination just go with it. I always found out where the library was in any particular small town. And also the movie house, like everybody else, because movies were something else. The films of George Pal, Destination Moon, When Worlds Collide, The War of the Worlds, all of that just used to flip me out.
How did you get to college?
I won a scholarship. I also went to college as a physics and mathematics major. I loved that field of human knowledge. You know, my older brother is an engineer. He designs computers in the Silicon Valley. And we were both going to go into science. At some point, though, I decided to go into writing.
So when you got out of college and you had studied literature and writing, why did you want to go back to where the migrant farm workers were, where you set up the El Teatro Campesino, working with Cesar Chavez and the migrant farm workers, the United Farm Workers Union?
Well, I think conditions were so bad, all right, that even as a child, it became obvious to me that something had to change. It was miserable. I even remember thinking as a child, what am I doing out here? I'm a kid, you know. But there were long hours, and the pay was very poor, and the living conditions were miserable. I mean, there's a lot of stories I could tell you, you know, that involve that whole life. Suffice it to say that I became aware that something was wrong and that justice was not being done. By that time, okay, I got to college, through high school into college, I had a political consciousness which fit exactly, you know, with the beginning of the 1960s. I joined what was essentially the civil rights movement in 1959. As a matter of fact, you know, the death of Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper and Buddy Holly in February of 1959. I've just been thinking about this lately. Marks a real turning point in my development because it's as if my youth was over. You know what I mean? I was no longer a teenager. And it was now time to think of other things. It was the most natural thing for me to do in 1965 is to go back to Delano, California, where I'd been born, and to work with Cesar Chavez and the union in an attempt to try to form some protection, an organization that would protect the farm workers.
You were performing sketches and plays for migrant farm workers, but you had a reputation that spread. I mean, you got off-Broadway awards and other theater awards. Your reputation spread around the West Coast and to the East Coast. How did people find out about you?
I think that it was because of the March to Sacramento in 1966, which was a phenomenal event. It's still, for me, the greatest case of theater that I've ever been involved in, theater in the world, you know, theater in reality. We marched up 300 miles up the spine of California, Highway 99, bearing our red flags with a Thunderbird eagle on it, passing semi-trucks and, you know, thousands of cars every day. And in the evenings, we'd settle in some little farm worker community, put up a flatbed truck, put up our banners, our backdrop, and speeches would be given, and the teatro would perform every night, 25 nights in a row. The press came from all over the country. They took our pictures. They took everybody's pictures. We were filmed for the first time, and people became aware of us. We were mentioned in Newsweek, and out of that came an invitation eventually from other colleges and universities to go perform, and that led to one morning when Pete Seeger called me and invited us to attend the Newport Folk Festival in 1967, exactly 20 years ago, which we did. Out of that came another performance at the Senate Subcommittee on Agricultural Labor. We performed in New York, and out of that came the OBE.
now that you're doing work for movies and for the theater, do you feel like you're still able to maintain the kind of political and social involvement that you started with?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a certain amount of natural evolution that takes place. I mean, I lived my 20s, and I was a typical person in their 20s. I was radical. I was furious. I was angry. I was the angry young man and enjoyed it, you know. I got my political rocks off, you know, in that sense. I feel that all of us that were active in the 1960s have a responsibility not to let America settle on an image of the 60s as if it was a period of flakes and kooks and weirdos. It was not. It was a period where the most basic chords in the American conscience were touched. And we cannot forget that. And yes, there's stuff that will fall away because it was silly. Every generation does have it. The drug thing certainly has gone awry, you know. The sexual revolution has become something else. But the social values, okay, who we're standing for, that was important.
Luis Valdez, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Luis Valdez's new film, La Bamba, opens nationally on July 24th. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's up for today?
Well, we'll cover day two of Admiral John Poindexter's testimony before the Iran-Contra committees. The former National Security Advisor had more today on what he did not tell the president about the diversion of funds to arm the Contras.
It's a big day in Philadelphia. 200 congressmen are commemorating the bicentennial of the Constitutional Convention.
That's right, including the members of the Iran-Contra committees. Today is the 200th anniversary of the Great Compromise, and we'll be talking about today's events and also the events of July 16th, 1787, and a report on a race in Switzerland of solar-powered vehicles. It's called the Tour du Sol.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie, RoboCop, is a futuristic look at law enforcement. It stars Peter Weller and Nancy Allen. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
The title makes it sound like some tatty syndicated TV sequel to The $6 Million Man, and the ad campaign is aimed at people whose IQs don't quite come up to their body temperature. So it may surprise you when I say that RoboCop is the best action movie so far this year. The best action movie, in fact, since The Terminator. And one of the wittiest, most inventive pictures you'll see this summer. Unfortunately, it doesn't begin very well. The year is 1991. The place is Detroit. And a cop is killed in a manner I found absurd. Thugs shoot him to pieces, laughing deliriously to show us how mean they are. RoboCop is full of creeps who think violence is funny, a conceit I found offensive, not because the violence is so blatant, although believe me, it is, but because even the most fiendish gangs of torturers probably don't giggle while they work. Not when they're killing cops. In fact, I was ready to dismiss RoboCop the same way I might dismiss the equally lewd and stupid violence in a picture like Death Wish 2, when suddenly this movie began to blossom. The dark humor in the cop-killing scene translates more tellingly to this scene of corporate chicanery. Ronnie Cox, the number two man in the private company that now owns Detroit's police force, is demonstrating his new law enforcement robot to his boss and senior management, including an unfortunate executive named Mr. Kinney.
Mr. Kinney, use your gun in a threatening manner.
Please put down your weapon. You now have 15 seconds to comply. You are in direct violation of Penal Code 113, Section 9. You now have 5 seconds to comply.
Dick, I'm very disappointed.
I'm sure it's only a glitch.
Well, a young hustler in the organization has been working on a better brand of robot. RoboCop, half machine and half Peter Weller, the officer who was killed at the beginning of the movie. As his story unfolds, so does a large and brilliantly imagined future world. The director, Paul Verhoeven, is Dutch. This is his first American film, and he proves to be a scurrilous wit who harpoons American social and political targets with all the vengeful energy of the culturally colonized. Verhoeven satirizes American news shows, sitcoms, the Strategic Defense Initiative, corporate politics, American manufacturing, nuclear policy, you name it. And he brings to his slashing social commentary the same crisp tone that he brings to the look of the film. RoboCop is acerbic, sleek, and bracingly dry, a cross between Max Headroom and Jonathan Swift. It's also, believe it or not, quite touching. When I heard that Peter Weller was to play a robot, that struck me as perfect typecasting. But Weller's very stiffness helps make the performance as moving as it is. RoboCop can remember traces of his human past. We see it dimly through his video eyes, and remember it through the foggy gridwork of his mind, and the effect is strange and entrancing and beautiful. This is a chilly movie, but its hero has an ironic and unexpected warmth. He may be a killing machine, but unlike most of the characters around him, he has the rueful, flickering soul of a man.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. He reviewed the movie RoboCop. Here's what's coming up on tomorrow's program. On our next show, I'll speak with dancer and choreographer Paul Taylor, who heads one of America's leading dance companies. Also, we'll feature a performance by Puerto Rican singer and songwriter Roy Brown, who sets the words of Latin America's preeminent poets to music. And Ken Tucker will review several recent home video releases, including Crimes of the Heart. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's program was produced by Fred Landerl with Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.